Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Toronto Blue Jays, so hot right now that even without playing yesterday, they make up a little ground in the American League East. Jays have won 8 of 9 coming off of that post-All-Star sweep of the Arizona Diamondbacks. They were off yesterday. Well-timed day off, even though it was only 3 games into the unofficial second half of the season because of what's going on with Kevin Gausman, because of what's going on with Jordan Romano, buying those guys a little extra time, letting the Blue Jays shuffle their rotation a little bit for this series that begins tonight down at Rogers Center against the San Diego Padres. Manoah, Berríos, Bassett against Musgrove, Darvish, Snell. We'll spend the show today teeing that one up, looking at what's gone into the Blue Jays' hot play of late. We have Chris Black at 11 o'clock in his usual Tuesday slot. Tony Gwynn Jr. of the Padres radio broadcast will join us a little later in the second hour as well. It's also a big draft talk day. Keith Law is going to come on around 11:30 or around 10:30 rather, and we'll talk a bunch of Jays draft stuff, especially now that some of the signings have started to trickle in. We know that Arjun Namala, who went 20th overall, signed for a little below slot. The Jays turn around and use some of that extra pool money on Landon Moutis, who signs well over slot. So we can sort through not only some of the picks, but some of the values we're starting to see come in. So that should be fun to talk with that about Keith. Of course, we'll sprinkle in some music talk as Keith always does. Jays, though, hot on their own. And then the Rays, Orioles, and Yankees all lose yesterday. That shrinks the Rays' lead in the American League East over the Blue Jays to just 5.5 games. The Jays are, of course, holding the second wild card spot right now, have a 2.5-game cushion over the first team out. So standings positionally, not a terrible spot, not where you want to be, but the fact that that American League East lead has shrunk to 5.5 is encouraging. The Orioles are the asterisk to that division lead shrinking, because not only are the Orioles standing in between the Jays and the Rays right now, they are also very hot. Last night's game aside, let's sort through some of what's kept the Blue Jays hot here and where the challenges lie in this series, dealing another series without Kevin Gausman against the San Diego Padres team that has been much worse than the Blue Jays, but spiritually similar, as a team that's really struggled in high leverage spots, underperformed the run differential, and certainly underperformed what the roster looks like on paper. Before we do any of that, though, Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic joins us now. Caitlin, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well. What did you think of the Chappie Couture shirt? We did a long talk about Matt Chapman heading into that promotion. I didn't get in-person eyes on it, but what did you make of it? What did you think?
No, I thought it was good. He added some things that I knew were part of his personality. There's like music notes on it to represent his love of music. I think there's some food and some beer. It's a very like SoCal type of shirt style as well, which obviously fits him. He's a very California boy. So yeah, I give it thumbs up.
Yeah, it looked great. Everyone seemed to enjoy it. We'll see those popping up around the Rogers Center down the stretch here. 3 start tonight at Rogers Center, Caitlin. The San Diego Padres in town. Jays have won 8 of 9, and despite that, and yeah, it's a weird 8 of 9 because it spans across the All-Star break, and it was the White Sox, and then within that Detroit series, they got no hit. Arizona is a team that's come back down to earth, and the Jays didn't play, you know, super well in that sweep, but a sweep's a sweep. 8 of 9 is 8 of 9. And we continue, Caitlin, to hear this team talk about, well, we haven't played our best baseball yet. What do you make of that being such a common talking point? And when they were playing poorly, certainly understandable. But now that the wins are coming and they're still saying that, has that kind of become a rallying cry for this group?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I do think they're playing better. Like, there was some sort of sloppy mistakes in Arizona. That was probably, you can chalk it up to, like, after the All-Star break kind of rust, or like everybody sort of getting back into it after the break. But I thought they played pretty well. Maybe I'm just sort of honing in on the pitching and the offense, because those are the two things that I thought did pretty well in that series. And defense, I don't really worry about with this team. So if there is, like, if Kevin Kiermaier makes, like, a bobble, it's like, well, that's going to happen, like, three times a year. Like, it's not common. So I don't get too concerned with that. So I actually think they're playing better. You know, they're 8 of 8, I guess, in games that they actually get a hit. So that's always good. But I think the offense is starting to come around. I think you're seeing more guys kind of click and get those big hits, like a guy like Danny Jansen getting a big knock. You know, Whit Merrifield has been, you know, pulling his weight and doing more than that. So, you know, I think that they are sort of starting to round into form. And this is a team that has always kind of seemed to peak more in the second half. I don't know if it's just like the warmer weather or whatever, but they always seem to get kind of hot in the second half. And so I'm kind of expecting the same, you know, pattern this year.
Yeah, it's a weird one. And Arden and I were talking about it yesterday, and there's not, you know, we couldn't come up with a good explanation for why that's the case. Like, okay, well, you need to play better, so you pick it up. You have veterans who know how to pace themselves, but why wouldn't they pace themselves to win a lot early so you can kind of ease up in the second half? It's a lot of, you know, there's probably some randomness to it. Now, I think we can all also agree that some of how the offense feels is going to ebb and flow with how things look for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. If you go back to, you know, the start of that Oakland series on June 23rd, it's been a sustained stretch of not MVP level Vlad, but over that 18 game stretch, you know, 18 RBI, the OPS up around 900. How much of a factor do you think that has? And again, it's not MVP level Vlad. It's just a, you know, a more reasonably good version of Vlad, the impact that has on how this lineup feels game to game.
Yeah, I think it's huge. I think like how he goes is often how the team goes or how the lineup goes. And it's probably not a coincidence that, you know, since he's come on a little bit, the team looks a lot better and you know, is winning a lot more often, more consistently. And, you know, he's a big part of the offense. He hits up in the top of the order. He's often in a position where he can drive in runs because Hufvud's ahead of him. He's just a sort of energetic, fun guy. And I think when he is having fun out there and sort of, you know, doing his job, I think that kind of carries through. There's always like the cliche that like hitting is contagious. Mm. And I think to some extent, when Vlad is hitting, it is it does go up and down the lineup a little bit. I think the guys really enjoy seeing Vladdy up there, and it's just you know, something that really helps the team get clicking a little bit. And so, yeah, I think he's looked good. I think even before the All-Star break, he was kind of saying that he felt more comfortable and sort of the bat was coming around. I think the Derby probably was a lot of fun for him. I know he loved winning it, and it was a bit of a spark for him. And I think you've seen that carry over a little bit in the second half. And so I think this Padres series is going to be really interesting to watch because, you know, the Padres have some pretty good starting pitching. That's not really been the issue with that team, or the issues with that team are a lot. But, yeah, I'm interested to see some of these, like, starting pitching matchups because it's pretty good.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. I mentioned them off the top that we're going to see Musgrove, Darvish, and Snell. Musgrove and Snell, who have been every bit as good as we've seen them in the past. Musgrove with a 3.29 ERA, Snell a 2.71. And then Yu Darvish, who's, you know, ERA is up around a little north of 4.5, but he's still Yu Darvish. I don't think, you know, if the Padres were four extra games out of the playoff race, we'd probably be circling him as a, maybe you could eat the money on him and help the rotation out kind of guy. When you look at this Padres series, not only because the Padres have those three starters lined up and it's a good test for the Jays lineup, but, you know, I wonder, too, if this is a battle of senses of urgency. And in the Jays case, that is because they're heating up right now and they have some ground to make up because they didn't play their best baseball for the first half of the season. And the Padres are just obviously in desperation mode right now if they're going to do anything but sell off at the deadline. They're 8 games out of a wild card spot right now and 6 games under 500. Does that element play in for you, too, where, you know, obviously the Padres by record are not a playoff team, but the chance to sharpen yourself against a very urgent team could be helpful as the Jays try to find that level of best ball?
Yeah, and like the Padres were coming off a pretty kind of deflating series loss to the Phillies, whereas the Blue Jays are coming off a series sweep. So you kind of had the two teams meeting, you know, at feeling probably different about where they're at right now. You know, one team coming in pretty hot, one team not. And, you know, the Blue Jays, they want to look at it too. Is like, this is a time where the Rays look like they're really faltering. You know, the Orioles had been playing really, really well, and they are playing the Dodgers this week. So maybe that's also an opportunity. Not that I don't know how much guys sort of look around and see who's playing who. And I don't know how deeply they look at the schedule. I would guess not so much. They just are kind of focusing on themselves and what they need to do. Cause you got to win your games. Doesn't matter if you don't win your games. But at the same time, like, this is a, like you said, an opportunity to kind of gain ground. They dug themselves a bit of a hole in the first half, and they're doing a good job sort of getting out of it. But you got to take advantage of both these home dates. The Blue Jays are playing at home a lot in the second half. So they've played pretty well at the Rogers Center recently. They want to continue that. And then, yeah, you want to take advantage of a Padres team that is probably feeling kind of low. Like, all season they haven't been performing well. Like I said, they're coming off a bad series loss against the Phillies. They, you know, could be sellers at the deadline, which is, like, not what anyone expected. So you want to really take advantage of that, I think. And, you know, like, not necessarily kick a team when it's down, but, I mean, it is Major League Baseball, and you got to take advantage when you can.
You have to, and strength of schedule is not static. You, if you get a team when they're in a lull, you got to beat them when they're in a lull. And if it looks better or worse after the fact, so be it. So this Padres team, you know, has probably been a couple different versions of this Padres team over the course of the year. And yeah, there's an urgency here, even with the strong starting pitchers. They, you know, how good would 10 of the last 12 look when we're talking about this, you know, heading into that Mariners series? So this series on the Jays pitching side is going to look a little different than maybe we anticipated. Part of that is that the Jays have continued to shuffle the rotation a little bit here out of the break around Kevin Gausman's day-to-day status. He didn't throw a proper side session on Sunday. He is not listed as a probable starter for this series. Caitlin, when you look ahead to the Seattle series, should we be concerned if John Schneider doesn't say, hey, Gausman's starting Friday today? You know, at some point they'd probably have to at least explore an IL stint if it's going to continue on. What have you made of the Gausman stuff out of the break here?
Yeah, I think it's a little concerning just because it's now somewhat prolonged. I mean, a 15-day IL stint backdated to his last start, which before the All-Star break, you're almost close to half of that, right, at this point. I think that, yeah, maybe today is the day that you need to decide if he's going on the IL or not, if he needs more time or, you know, to rest that side or not. So today might be a kind of a pivotal day. I don't know if they'll give us a guarantee like he's going to start in Seattle. Generally, the Blue Jays have not been super forthcoming with that kind of stuff, at least well ahead of time. I think they like to sort of keep that information close until they have to sort of reveal it. But we'll see. Like, maybe if he's feeling good, they'll just say, yeah, he's going to go sometime in the Seattle series, and that will be a good thing if it's sort of up in the air. And then I think it's fair to be a little bit concerned. I mean, this guy is your most important pitcher, one of your most important players. You need him in the second half. And so that, in that way, I understand why they're being extra, extra cautious. Like, there's really no point, especially at this point in the schedule. Like, yeah, you're playing some good teams. Arizona's a good team, and the Padres are, you know, talented. They've got some good people on their team. But ultimately, like, maybe this is a time in the schedule where you can give him some rest, and you don't want him to aggravate that side and make it worse and then have to put him on the IL, and he's, you know, off for 2 weeks in August or 3 weeks in August or, you know, worst case scenario, longer than that. So I understand why they're being cautious. It doesn't, you know, seem like it's too serious, but at the same time, I think we'll want to wait and see what we hear today. And it will be reassuring to see if he starts Seattle. I would think that he would, and if he doesn't, then I would expect he goes on the IL, because at this point, like, he's kind of been off long enough, you might as well put him there and get another arm.
So 2 weeks ago, we may have been looking at this and thinking, well, he's got a pitch, there's nobody else, this is a disaster. And now Alek Manoah is back, so you can at least, you know, use the off day and juggle the rotation in a way that uses an actual fifth starter to help you through this. Alek Manoah, obviously only one start in. It was against the Detroit Tigers. There was a lot of good Canada in with some, we should probably still keep an eye on this before we get too excited about Manoah being back. He'll be back on the hill tonight. What are you most looking at with Alek Manoah in terms of progressing from that first start back last Friday?
Yeah, and just looking to build off of kind of the pace of the delivery, make sure the delivery is as smooth. And I'm sort of looking at, like, how efficient can he be with his pitches? Can he put guys away if he gets ahead? That's the one thing that I've noticed, whereas, like, last year it was really common for him to get ahead of batters and then be able to just put them away very quickly and efficiently. And this year it feels like he's in more 3-2 counts. He might be ahead and then fall behind or pitch two balls or whatever. And so I think that that's what I'm kind of looking for is, can he get ahead of guys and then put them away? Can he be efficient with his pitches? You know, can he be able to go 6 innings, you know, even 7 innings? Like, that would be great. I'm sure the Blue Jays are just really hoping for 6 quality innings because these are sort of stepping stones that you want from him. And, yeah, he looked really good against the Tigers. You know, another thing you want to watch for with Manoah is, how does he kind of, like, look out there on the mound? How's his demeanor? Is he looking kind of energized? Is he looking like he's very engaged and, like, having fun out there? You know, if he strikes a guy out, is he kind of hopping off the mound? Is he, like, not in a disrespectful way or anything, but just mean, like, in the way that he kind of hypes himself up? I noticed that against the Tigers, and I thought, like, he had a really positive body language, and I think when he was really struggling, at times you didn't see that. It didn't seem like it was a good time out there, sort of understandably so when the results weren't coming. So, yeah, I'm kind of watching for both sort of like mechanics and like pitch efficiency, but also just kind of more like body language and things like that, because I think that's always like a sign of like, how's Manoah doing out there? Like, does he look like kind of vintage Manoah? That's usually like a good sign.
It is a good sign. So that's one way to help with the Kevin Gausman delay here. Another way would be to, hey, on the weekend, if he can't go, if he just needs another couple days, you go back to, a bullpen style day. But Caitlin, I mean, we saw a little bit of it on the weekend, what it looks like when you have Trevor Richards back into more of a leverage spot. Now, on Friday, he did give up the home run, but he also recorded 5 outs for them, came in Sunday, was effective again. How big is it for this bullpen with how heavily they've had to lean on the back end arms? You know, like, obviously it's possible they might need a bullpen day at some point over the course of the second half of the season. You can't control everything and there's 68 games left. It might happen, but Trevor Richards being added back to that mix with Swanson, Romano, Meza, Garcia, I mean, it has to make John Schneider's job just so much easier having the fifth starter back for the Richards component.
Yeah, for sure. And Richards has been such a key guy for the bullpen, and not even just the bullpen, but honestly, like, the entire pitching staff, I guess, the way that he's been so flexible with his role and able to do so many different things. And yeah, it really helps if you can put Richards in the seventh, because then you could either go for Garcia or Swanson in the eighth, and then Romano, assuming that he's good to go now, in the ninth. So you're not always having to go, you know, Garcia, Swanson, and then Romano. You always have Tim Meza for, you know, matchups against lefties. He's been really good too, but, you know, you're kind of selective with the way they use him, although he's pretty much been effective all around this year, but still, like, you want to maximize his potential against, you know, lefties in the opposing lineup. And so it's really great to have a guy like Richards who you also can use, you know, against lefties, against righties. He's really effective. The changeup is an excellent pitch that's been really great for him this year. It's kind of helped his bounce back basically by just using the best pitch that he has even more and playing off his fastball. So yeah, his performance is huge, and I think that the fact that he can still go multi-innings, that's, you know, really good for the Blue Jays. But I think also just having him as like almost a leverage arm as well, it just makes him so flexible. You can use him so many different ways, and like you said, it's huge. It was huge also the way that, you know, they didn't have Romano for basically that weekend series against the Arizona Diamondbacks. And they weren't really worse for wear, really. Like, they got through the series. They swept the series. The bullpen was excellent. The performance outside of Mitch White, it was basically almost a flawless performance outside of a hiccup here and there. And so, yeah, his performance is, you know, really huge. And that's why you kind of want to keep him in that bullpen role. Like you said, you might have to use a bullpen day here or there. that's fine. But the more you can use him in leverage spots and have him sort of available whenever you need him, I think that's how he's most effective.
Or instead of a bullpen day, hey, Hyunjin Ryu started at AAA on the weekend. He's not too far away. I think at this point, you know, this is mostly a fun story to keep an eye on. But Arden had suggested to me yesterday, not reporting, just kicking it around, like if Gausman can't go on the weekend and Ryu's scheduled to pitch at AAA anyway, why not? I know that Hyunjin Ryu also has an impact on this dugout, and he's around the team a lot through his rehab and things like that. How excited would you be if we get Hyunjin Ryu back on a major league mound in the next couple weeks?
Yeah, I think it would be a great story. I mean, I remember last year writing when he went down with Tommy John and writing, like, have we seen the last of Hyunjin Ryu as a Blue Jay? Just because it's like, you never know how long Tommy John recovery is going to take. It's always about 12 to 14, maybe sometimes even 16 months for some guys. And he was he was having that surgery when he was 35 years old. He's 36 years old now. Like, you don't know how someone's going to rebound from that. And so it was totally possible. Last year when we heard the news, like, is he going to pitch again? Like, the Blue Jays were obviously optimistic he would, but you never know what happens with those situations. And so the fact that he could, and the fact that he could, honestly, like, right around the trade deadline, which is, yeah, probably, I mean, maybe they pitch him sooner than that. The Blue Jays obviously didn't need, like, Manoah to have a ton of minor league starts, so there's sort of precedent for them. Not saying they rush anyone here, but, I mean, if a guy's ready to go, a guy's ready to go, and they'll usually, determine that based on, you know, how he's pitched and how he's feeling. So I don't know if they would do that. I would expect maybe at least one more minor league start from Hyunjin Ryu, but maybe if they're in a situation and, you know, they really don't want to use bullpen day or whatever, then maybe it's possible. But I'm just excited to see him pitch again. I think he has, I haven't seen him pitch, but I've looked at the lines and his pitching seems pretty good. AAA, the last time out, I think he pitched 5 innings and I think he only gave up a run.
Yeah, and he did it very efficiently as well in terms of pitch efficiency and a couple of strikeouts there. The velocity touched 90, which is an important indicator for him since he was at 88 in his first rehab start back. Caitlin, I have structured the questions in the sequencing here in a way to set you up for it. One, you wrote about Kevin Gausman's injury at The Athletic the other day. The tease in the headline was that, hey, it's a reminder of the Blue Jays' deadline needs. And we just went through, well, maybe Gausman's okay and he can pitch on the weekend. Hey, Alec Manoah's back. You have the bullpen day option. Hyunjin Ryu exists. But, and we'll talk about this more next week as we're much closer to the deadline. Caitlin, within that piece, you make it fairly clear you still think this is an area that the team should at least be exploring some depth options ahead of August 1st.
Yeah, I don't think it hurts. I mean, I think that, again, like the Gausman situation is just kind of one of those reminders. And then you can even go back to the Manoah situation where you think, like, hey, when one of their starters went down, like, what did they do? Oh, they basically had to go for a 4-man rotation and they used bullpen days and kind of really tire out their rotation for a little bit there. It wasn't ideal. Everybody did their job. No one really complained about it and everybody handled it really well. But at the same time, like, it was, you know, it was a tough ask for some of those starters to do that. And so I think that there is room on this team for some depth. And, you know, trading for depth, it can be tricky sometimes because you're not necessarily trading for a guy that, like, might have options, or you know, guys that have options are younger, so teams aren't necessarily, like, trading them away. The Blue Jays, tried to do that last year with Mitch White. That trade doesn't totally look like it's working out right now. Mitch White is struggling, really not being used very much. And then when he was used, obviously the other day, it did not go so well. And so, you know, I think the Blue Jays could use someone that was maybe a more effective swingman that could do that. I think that there is no harm in searching for some starting depth. Maybe there's a role in which Kikuchi does go to the bullpen. I think that the situation with Manoah, you really have to see how he goes in his next few outings. I think Hyunjin Ryu, I know we just talked about him and how great it would be to see him, but, like, that's still a huge question mark how he's going to perform. I mean, there's a huge difference between AAA starters and major league, or AAA hitters, I should say, and major league hitters. And so I still think, like, yeah, on paper they have 5, maybe 6 starters, but, like, there's now at this point kind of 3 question marks with 3 of those guys, and you're 2 weeks out from the deadline about. it doesn't hurt to shop around. It doesn't hurt to get some depth. And it doesn't hurt to maybe get a veteran that could slide into the bullpen, could start a little bit, could do multiple things. You know, depth, I think, should be something the team is searching for at the deadline.
This is why the MLB trade deadline is so great. Things are going well. The team is hot. They're getting bodies back. And still, yeah, you gotta be active. You always have to be looking for more. Caitlin, I'm sure we'll talk to you a lot more again next week about some of those particular trade deadline targets and other areas the Jays could shore up ahead of August 1st. Thank you for taking the time out this morning. I'll see you down at the park a little later.
Awesome. Thank you.
Caitlin McGrath of The Athletic. Make sure to check out all of her work over at theathletic.com. Again, a little breakdown of the Gausman injury and why it reinforces the Jays' need to look for starting pitching depth. Had a couple of good pieces of the Jays' offense starting to click and take advantage of some opportunities from that Diamondback series, as well as some bigger trade deadline questions around Alek Manoah, etc. She also teamed up with Keith Law to write about Arjun Amala, who is the Jays' first-round pick. He went 20th overall. He was expected to be a top-10 pick. Keith Law had him at number 8 on his big board. How did the Jays get him at number 20 then? How did that set up the rest of their draft board? How have things shaken out in the early days of draft pick signings here for the Blue Jays? Keith Law of The Athletic joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Discussing the biggest stories that matter to Toronto sports fans. The Fan Morning Show with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Toronto Blue Jays did some work over All-Star Weekend while winning a home run derby, having a couple guys participate in the Futures game. Also, a couple days of the Major League Baseball draft. We are also 1 year out from last year's draft, so you can start to check in earnest on some of last year's picks. When the Jays had 4 selections in the first and second rounds because of some compensation picks. This year, not so much. They picked 20th. They didn't pick again until 89. They had to do their work primarily in the depth rounds, but that number 20 pick ended up playing out in a pretty interesting fashion. Keith Law of The Athletic joins us now to help us break it down. Keith, how are you, man?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am excellent, and I played that song that you put me onto by Pip Blom off the top. I was shocked to learn that the guy from Franz Ferdinand's name, though, is not actually Franz Ferdinand.
I'm pretty sure Franz Ferdinand is dead.
Yeah, but I never know with parents and things like that. There are, you know, there are always unfortunate names around the world. Keith, how was draft weekend? How was Seattle?
Seattle was great. Had a blast there. Saw some friends. Did a ton of walking. It's an amazing city. I hadn't been there in about 20 years. It was cool. That was the biggest thing. It was about 15 plus degrees cooler than it has been here in Delaware. So it was nice to get out of the heat and the humidity for a bit.
Nice. Did you get to go to the Sub Pop Records shop at all? I know you're a big music guy, so I my mind immediately goes to like Seattle music iconic places.
No, I had no time for, the only times I left the hotel, to go to the Futures game in the draft or to eat. Otherwise I was just writing the entire weekend. So I didn't get to do any touristy things.
Well, I'm surprised to hear that your weekend was so busy, given it was the MLB draft and the Futures game. So, Keith, you have a bunch of stuff up at The Athletic. Of course, you had your final mock. You had your pick-by-pick breakdown of the first round. And then, you know, the big one, if you are a fan of a specific team, you've got kind of the draft wrap for each team around baseball. The Toronto Blue Jays had a pretty interesting one, getting a player that you had at number 8 on your big board down at number 20. What should Blue Jays fans be excited about with Arjun Amala, and how did he slip to 20 if he was considered not just by you, but pretty consistently a top 10-ish talent in this draft?
I'll answer the second question first. I don't know exactly why he slipped that far. I do know that there was a lot of talk leading up to the draft that he was sliding, that whatever his asking price was in terms of a signing bonus, and whether it's an actual asking price or just the perception of his signability, was high enough that some teams were backing off. Like, he may have been originally asking for a top 10 bonus, and teams decided they would rather not go that direction. He ended up getting under slot, taking under slot at pick 20. So maybe that's not true. That's not what he was asking for. I don't know for sure. I just know there was a lot of chatter that he was one of a couple of names who were pretty clearly sliding as we were getting close to the draft. He is a 17-year-old shortstop. I don't think he'll turn 18 until October. He already shows pretty impressive power for someone his age with a body that's going to allow him to put on quite a bit of strength as he gets older. And I think he's going to hit for power and for some average. There's been some swing and miss. I'm willing to tolerate a little bit more of that in a 17-year-old. He's for me, he's a shortstop. We'll see how big he gets when he's 23, 24. But I like his actions. I like his hands. He's got a great arm. Right now, it's a shortstop's body. And if he doesn't outgrow the position, I think he'll stay there and actually be a reasonably good one. At worst, he ends up at third base. You're hoping for a power-hitting third baseman. It's all going to come down to the bat. What kind of contact, how much contact, especially, is he making as he gets older? But the fact that he's only 17 also does add that extra year of development time.
It adds an extra year of development time. And then when you have a standout skill like the power, you know, maybe there's a little more patience with, like you said, with some of the flaws, some of the swing and miss stuff. And hey, maybe there's a real upside if the Jays can do, you know, the player development thing and improve the swing decisions and things like that in a way that it appears it's starting to click for Aurelvis Martinez, another guy who shortstop with power, maybe ends up at third base, who we can talk about a little later. So with Nymala, you know, if he was on talent, maybe a top 10 guy or eighth, like on your board, and we look at the bonus slot for, say, the 10th pick, and the, you know, the slot there is $5.5 million, and then we see him slide to 20, and the Jays get him for $746,000 under slot. So they get him for about $3 million. You know, how, if you're sitting there as a front office, how much does that change your approach to the draft or set up the draft board for you the next couple of days to get a guy not only who slid like that, but I'd imagine at the time they had an idea he was gettable for $3 million and not, you know, $4 million or $5 million. How much does a Nymala slide on the first day of the draft alter things for a front office's approach from there?
Well, it allows you when you're getting a player, I'm assuming the Blue Jays valued him as more than the 20th best prospect in the draft. And so one, I'm sure they were ecstatic when it seemed like he might be available because of the way that the draft board was shaping up. And two, when you realize you're going to get a player you do like at a number that's under slot, you can start to think about what player or players you might want to take in later rounds. And for the Blue Jays, that was waiting until day two because they didn't have a second round pick. What player or players you might target to go over slot. There was, because this was such a strong college draft, especially a college position player draft, there was quite a bit of high school talent available to teams, even as we entered day two, even after about 70 players were off the board already, there was still quite a bit of talent to spend money on. And when you have about $750,000 US to potentially go over slot for later players, that gives you a lot of flexibility and you can essentially start shopping. You can talk to agents and or players and say, if we offer you $750,000 over slot at our next pick, does that get it done? Is that enough to entice you to sign rather than, say, going to college?
So the Jays, we saw them do that in the fourth round. So the third round, they take Watts Brown, who I know you had mentioned has more of a reliever profile, but could develop into a starter in the right system. Then fourth round, they go with Landon Moraitis, who ends up signing for close to $1 million over slot. It seemed like the numbers are not exact, but you see the discount below slot for Nymala, and then you see the bonus over slot for Moraitis. Do you like the use of that money on that prospect in particular, a guy who was ranked some places as a top 75 prospect, getting him in the fourth round, a high school arm, not a college player there?
He wasn't the guy that I would have picked necessarily, okay. But that said, you know, he is a projection high school right-hander. First of all, there's a lot in the eye of the beholder. And second, you know, a lot of those guys, if you get one of those and just go get a high school pitcher with a lot of projection, and keep him healthy. A lot of those guys just tend to surprise. So he was outside of my top 100. But that said, that's not to say there's anything that he's a bad prospect, for example. He just maybe isn't exactly the name I would have picked at that spot. Also, bear in mind, I don't know everyone's signability. So there may be prospects I'll say, I would have taken so-and-so instead. And it turns out he wanted $6 million. So that's not really very realistic. But I do think my concern with Marudis is his curveball right now is below average. He might have to switch to a slider. We don't really see a lot of evidence that he can spin the ball right now, which isn't to say he never will be able to. But I'd like to see a little bit more. You know, high school projection guy, I think there were some others on the board who I did like more. But I will be very curious to see what he looks like, say, next spring. Once the Blue Jays get him in, get to work with him a little bit this summer, I assume he'll do some work in instructs maybe over the winter. Let's see next spring how hard he's throwing, what the breaking ball looks like. Maybe even if they change the delivery a little bit, because he did have one of the shortest arm actions I saw in anybody in the draft class.
Now, so when it comes to a short arm action and how a team might want to tweak that, is the length of the arm action related to the ability to spin the ball, or is that more just it's not as projectable a delivery mechanic?
I don't think it's speaking a little bit out of my area here, but I do not believe that the length of the arm action is tied to the ability to spin the ball. I think, particularly when it comes to a curveball, I'm largely a believer you're either born with that ability or you're not. Whether you have it in the wrist to throw a curveball and get sufficient spin on the pitch to make it an effective curveball, and I think a lot of guys who just can't do that for whatever reason, it's just they don't have the wrist for that. You can switch those guys to a slider and then see. And often a slider, you still want some spin. We do high spin sliders do tend to be a bit better, and we're looking for especially the spin-based movement on that pitch to be different from what is on the fastball. But if you have arm strength, that can often help a slider play up too. It's not all that you need, but simply being able to throw a slider harder is better. Whereas with a curveball, that's not necessarily true. I think the arm action is a little bit – it is a different – factor there. And by the way, having extremely short arm action is not necessarily bad. It's just different and maybe not as easy to work with if you do decide you need to make adjustments.
That makes sense. So elsewhere in this draft, so they get Namala at number 20, and it seems like, you know, on ranking, on dollar value, that's a pretty nice upside play, and a guy who I know you mentioned, you know, could have 60, maybe even higher grade power than that. Eventually, Marudis, who you're maybe mixed on, what did you make of the, if we zoom out a little bit here, and now that we're starting to see some of the signing amounts come in, where would you, you know, kind of put the Jays draft over? I know you don't do draft grades, but did you feel like it was a good couple of days for them once we start looking at the guys they got in those middle rounds, 5, 6, 7, 8?
Yeah, because what they, in 6 and 7 too, they had some college guys who were just really good picks for those spots, like Jay Sparrow, and I actually had somebody text me, what the heck happened to him? How did he end up in the 6th round? And I actually don't have a good answer for that, because it seemed like he had a solid spring, and he ended up signing for slot in the 6th round too. So, which I thought was, he's an outfielder from the University of Arkansas, and he can really hit a fastball, and there's quite a bit of power there. If the Blue Jays can work with him on better picking up pitch types, which is not an easy thing, but there's a chance for an above average regular there. And I thought he was going to go probably in the 3rd round, maybe a little bit higher, because college position players with any kind of performance do tend to get run up the board a little bit. And then they took Nick Goodwin of Kansas State in the 7th round, another guy who, yeah, I thought he was probably more of a 4th rounder-ish, give or take. A guy I thought was going to go a lot higher. I think the industry thought he was going to go a lot higher. And a decent amount of it was that, and he actually was okay on the Cape a year ago, which generally is a thing that can help a college hitter quite a bit, because they're using wood bats there. I don't think he's necessarily a regular. I think he's probably, because he's never hit. That's the one thing, even though he's got pretty good bat speed and he seems to have an idea of the strike zone, and it's not weak contact necessarily, but he's just never hit for high average anywhere. And after, you know, in 1 year you say, oh, that might be bad luck. In 3 years you say, okay, something's definitely up here. But to take that guy with that profile in the 7th round, I'll do that all day long. And I think that ended up helping the fact that they didn't have that second round pick. They took two guys in the sixth and seventh round who were also much better than their position in the draft in terms of, I think, how the industry perceived them and certainly how I perceive them. And I think that elevates the draft class to one that's probably more middle of the pack, which is hard to do because they had fewer picks than most teams.
Yeah. Hey, I think when you only have one pick in the first 88 selections, you're happy with middle of the pack, especially after a year where you had four kind of picks in the first two rounds, plus the compensation round. Nick Goodwin, the name you mentioned, is a fascinating one to me because you highlighted his like criminally low batting average on balls in play year over year at Kansas State and in the Cape League. And you're right. Like the batting averages don't look that spicy, even though he doesn't, you know, there's the bat to ball skill and the bat speed or whatever. And then you look and it's like, okay, well, maybe he's like a big plodding first base type. No, he is a utility infielder who can even play some outfield. It doesn't make and he steals bases. The low BABIP stuff doesn't make a ton of sense. And there's an interesting thing that you mentioned, you know, in your piece that his bat is in and out of the zone so quickly that he doesn't make enough solid contact. It struck me as, you know, the bat speed is almost too good that it becomes a negative at that point. Is that something, you know, you figure that a team is going to be able to help him with, hey, bat speed's a plus, but we need to keep you longer in the zone? Or is that another one of those things that is maybe more innate, like the ability to pop a curveball off?
I'll be honest. That's just my hypothesis on him. That's not from any scouts. That's just from me.
It's a reasonable hypothesis.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't know of examples of guys who've had that before and then changed because it's not that common. Mm-hmm. It's not something I see very much. And honestly, it's something I think I hear sometimes about players. And I'm like, that's not possible, right? Is that really true? If you're swinging, you got bat speed, you got strength, as long as you square the ball up. But clearly he's not squaring the ball up. I don't know what exactly it is, but he's not making good enough contact to end up with a higher BABIP. That's just the bottom line. Like I said, in one season of college data, you could say that's a fluke. Plenty of guys have done that and then turned out to have decent big league careers. When it's this consistent over, what are we talking about, 700 or so plate appearances, then you start to say something is not adding up here. But again, that's also why he's there in the seventh round, not in the third. If this guy hits for average, he's a second or third rounder.
Right. And that makes sense. And that's, hey, when you only have the one early pick, maybe that was part of the strategy. And it seemed like it, you know, obviously we can't take consensus rankings as gospel or anything like that. But the Jays did have a number of picks that were, hey, this guy had slid a little bit relative to industry expectations. So maybe that was a part of the strategy. Keith, we're a year out, obviously, because this year's draft happened from last year's draft. And when you look back on that one, the Jays had Brandon Barriera in the first round, Josh Kasevich, Tucker Thoman, Cade Doughty, all as guys in the first, second, or compensation round. I know you've been heavy on this year's draft, but about a year out, I know you told me, you know, earlier this season, this is about the time you start to check in on those guys and really gauge the progress. A year out from the Jays 2022 draft, do you still feel as strongly it was a pretty good thing, a pretty good day, or has the Brandon Barriera question mark kind of colored that differently the last year?
I mean, it has, right? They invested so heavily in him. He got a higher bonus, about $600,000 higher than Namala got this year, and he was picked actually three spots later. I think he was over slot. And you know, him showing up heavy this year, and not the good way that's pretty concerning, especially for a 19-year-old. You'd really like to see the conditioning. Conditioning can become a problem for guys certainly later in their career. You don't like to see that happening to guys quite so early in the career. So, you know, that does color it. Tucker Thoman, who was their other kind of big over-slot guy, he was their third overall pick also, right after the second round, has not gotten off to a great start. I'm not overly concerned, but he's punching out quite a bit more than I would have hoped to have seen just in his first year in pro ball. I do try to bear in mind with a lot of these high school hitters now, in the past they might have gone to short season. The short season doesn't exist anymore. Like maybe that would have been the better spot for him. Let's come up with Elijah Green, who was the fifth overall pick last year and has punched out well over 100 times, I think, already in low A as a 19-year-old. Those are guys who wouldn't be in low A. They wouldn't be in full season ball. They'd be in short season. And so I do think we have to adjust our expectations a little bit and maybe give them a little bit more slack before saying, oh, there might be a real concern here.
And then the other two, Kasevich and Kay Doughty, were guys who, they're both already 22. Kasevich is even pushing 23. Those are guys who are in high A ball already. And, you know, that Vancouver Canadiens team, it has been very, very good. They're putting together something special there in Vancouver right now. But both of those guys have just kind of been okay to solid. When it's an older prospect that we expected to be kind of quick through the minors, you know, it's still their first full minor league season, but age 22 at high A, how do you calibrate those guys and what they're doing as overage prospects?
If you're a little overage, actually 22, and especially a major college graduate, which both of those guys are, they played at major programs. So for Kay Doughty to be 22 with that experience in high A and striking out 30% of the time and not even hitting for a ton of power, that's pretty concerning to me, actually. And again, not giving up on the guy entirely, but that is absolutely below what I would have expected for a guy who played at LSU. They just won the national championship. They play in the SEC. They face the best pitching. High A really shouldn't have been this much of a problem for him. And it is a concern. He's far from the only high draft pick out of a college last year who has then gone on to struggle in high A this year. But yeah, I don't love to see it. And that strikeout rate really needs to come down in the second half. Because you take a guy like that out of an LSU, you're hoping he starts the year in high A. And by this point in the year, you're talking about promoting him to double A. They won't all get there, but you're hoping that's the track that player is on. And he in particular is not. Kasevich has been pretty much what I would have expected him to be. But he was the lowest upside of those four guys. He was a high contact, no power guy with a good chance to stay at shortstop. If he ever developed more power, he'd be a very different player, but that was not that likely. Doughty is the one I'm more concerned about. So I would say, yeah, because their draft was basically about those big four mm-hmm. picks, and none of them is off to a great start. And only one of them, I would say, is off to a start that is in line with expectations.
That's a tough one. Hopefully it's a good second half for them. Keith, I know that you probably haven't gotten eyes on it yet, but quickly before I let you go, when you look at Aurelvis Martinez's stat line, you see the strikeout rate down from 28.5% to 20.5%. You see the walk rate nearly double and the power is still there. Obviously, you got to get eyes on New Hampshire and you got to talk to people, but how positive an indicator is that for you? Because he's still just 21 at the double A level, and I know he's repeating, but you know, when we talked at the end of last year about the areas he needed to improve and you know, to kind of stay on that top 100 radar, be a potential near-term major league option, at least from scouting the stat line, it looks like he's headed in the right direction here.
Yeah, his last month or so has been quite a bit better, although he did punch out six times total in his last two starts, so it's obviously less than ideal. But the last 30-odd games, I think, since June 1st, right, he's got a .424 on base. He's walked almost as much as he's struck out. He's only struck out about a fifth of the time in that period. And he's young. I feel like we talked about this at the end of last year, towards the end of last year, and it's like, this guy was really young to be in double-A, to be starting the year in double-A. He's 21 this entire season. He won't turn 22 until November, right? We're talking about a 22-year-old Kay Doughty is struggling in high-A. So, yes, Aurelvis is repeating the level. That is a concern. That is something that is a factor to take into account when trying to evaluate the performance. That said, he's also doing exactly what you need to do when you repeat the level. He's showing substantial improvement in some of the most fundamental ways, like improving the contact rate and improving his walk rate. And I believe in the underlying batted ball stats that all checks out. We'll see what happens when they bump him to AAA, which I'm sure they will before the season is out. But this is good to see, because we always knew he had the power. It's just, is he going to hit enough for the power to play? And the last month or so should have at least changed the evaluation on him a little bit to say, oh, maybe it's still there. Maybe he was just young, pushed too quickly to double A last year, and we need to be patient.
That to me sounds like a guy who could be the key piece of a Shohei Ohtani trade. And yeah, he gets above the AAA with the Salt Lake Bees. Keith Law, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Keith Law of The Athletic. You can read more on all of the Jays draft picks on Keith Law's pages at The Athletic. Again, breakdown of every team in each league and a high level snapshot of what the draft is, a quick blurb on each guy within the first 10 rounds. And then you can click through, obviously, to see more in-depth scouting reports on all of those players. The Namala stuff is pretty interesting. I mean, he's obviously checked some boxes as a fan favorite here in the early days. I think he's going to be an exciting kid to follow. And like he said, one of the absolute youngest players in the draft. So when we talk about, you know, Aurelvis being 21 at AA and not 22 to the offseason versus what a Kusevich looks like, you got a long runway to turn a prospect like that into a productive player. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet at Down to Black on Twitter, joins us for his regular Tuesday hit. And a little later in that area, Tony Gwynn Jr. from the Padres radio broadcast will join us. That's all next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything Raptors before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. It's Tuesday, so Chris Black is with us at Down to Black on Twitter, Sportsnet producer, the only guest who requests his own music but doesn't have headphones on in the studio, so can't even hear that I gave him Jurassic 5 this time.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I should have been wearing headphones.
Oh, well. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well. It's a fun time of the year. I've been listening to a bunch of your shows, to everyone's shows, and there's a lot of good talking points, right, these days?
Yeah, some you agree with, some that you don't.
It's good to disagree sometimes.
Yes.
You and I agree far too often. So
on baseball.
Yes.
Basketball, we can have it out.
It's,
Another
day.
The segment with Eric Green pre-All-Star break didn't work out. We couldn't get him connected from Vegas. But, yes, we did the whole, hey, Blue Jays reasonablest, Raptors reasonablest, flip roles for the different sports bit. But then we couldn't stay connected with them.
I think the three of us need to get in here one day and really hash it out. Really hash out Raptors and Blue Jays.
Yeah, and then we got to find some other thing for me to be irrational about instead of the
you're
middle
irrational
ground.
About everything. That's at least
not,
that I
that's
know.
Not true.
Yeah.
I can get there. Okay, so the big one heading into this year, obviously the Jays are playing better. You know, we're seeing some things on the offensive side that are encouraging. We'll get to that stuff. But the highlight item tonight, in part because Kevin Gausman continues to deal with a side thing. Rotation's been tweaked a little bit. We'll see Alek Manoah on the hill tonight. It's been a while since we saw him again because of the All-Star break, and it had been a while before that. So if we think back to that first start back from the minors against the Detroit Tigers the Friday before the All-Star break, I know it's a little bit, it's 10 days ago now, but what did you see that you liked? What did you see that, you know, you're keeping a cautious eye on tonight?
Definitely, I think the pitch that stood out was the slider.
In a bad way.
But kind of good and bad.
Okay.
Like, I think there were good ones. There were unquestionably some good ones. Like, when you look at the output or the production, or you look at the page, the Baseball Savant page of what he did with the slider, the Tigers were 0-for-7 against it. He had 4 strikeouts with it. So you can't just say, oh, he threw some backup ones and it wasn't great. But, you know, when you break down the numbers of what those pitches did, I believe he had, now, and this isn't the be-all and end-all, but if he had, I believe, a season-high amount of sliders that broke less than 10 inches across. So he had, and that's a way of, you know, that's a way of quantifying. We saw a lot of sliders that backed up that didn't necessarily go where he wanted them to. Now, having said that, he didn't really leave a lot of those sliders that backed up or didn't go where he wanted to. He didn't leave them over right in the heart of the plate. They kind of backed up and stayed inside against some righties, and he didn't get burned by it. So I think one of the biggest misconceptions in this sport when we watch it is every mistake that a pitcher makes gets hit. Every pitcher gets away with mistakes, and he got away with some. So I don't think the slider was necessarily bad. I think he had really good results with it, but that's a pitch I'm going to be watching closely today against some higher quality hitters.
Some higher quality hitters and a team that hits righty sliders fairly well. They are not, the Padres have underperformed very dramatically this year on both sides of the ball, and they don't, you know, stack the lineup with a ton of dangerous lefties. Of course, there's Juan Soto in there, but I don't know that Jake Cronenworth and Trent Grisham and guys like that are terrifying you. But as a team, they do hit righty sliders pretty well. So when you talk about those ones that kind of backed up on them or didn't break a ton, obviously that's not nothing. But in terms of when he used them or the conviction of using them in certain counts? Did you see some progress there? Because we had seen, even before his numbers started going really badly at the major league level, we were seeing a lot of difficulty once he got to two strikes. Did you like, whether it was with the slider or another pitch in two strike situations, did you like how he handled being ahead in counts a little better?
I like how he attacked with two strikes, 100%. It was being around the zone. It wasn't throwing pitches a foot out of the zone and hoping for chase. It was throwing pitches in the zone, at the edge of the zone, and challenging hitters. And it was that demeanor that we've heard a lot of guys talk about. I just like the way he challenged guys. Now, what stood out to me was, it seemed, the analogy I used on Twitter yesterday was, it seemed like he seemed like a golfer who was very cognizant of keeping the ball in play, keeping the ball in the fairway, and almost like dialing back on a lot of his pitches. And I think that has something to do with the sliders as well, keeping them in the zone, but maybe not breaking as much. So one of the things I'm interested in watching is, does he let it rip a bit more tonight as the confidence grows of staying in the zone? One thing I didn't mention is he had a season high rate of pitches in the strike zone.
Mm-hmm. So that 56%, I think.
Well, whatever it was, but like, to me, like, that's big. And I'll take the stuff not being as sharp, because we want it. If you asked, when you asked me a week or two ago what I'd be looking for, it was being in the zone. You asked Ben Nicholson-Smith before Manoah's start, it was being in the strike zone. Like, people didn't care about seeing nasty stuff from him. They wanted to see, was he capable of keeping pitches in the zone? And he showed he was. So he's got to do it again. But I'm interested to see if, as that confidence grows, does the stuff kind of tick up as well?
One thing I don't mean to be negative about this, but we're one start back and we have to be a little cautious here. So within that, he did throw, you know, a season high zone rate. So 56% of pitches in the zone. Now, where you'd really love to see that, and maybe this is the next step, is you'd love to see that edge percentage go up, right? So for anyone who hasn't heard us talk about it before, you can break the strike zone down into, okay, here's what's over the heart of the plate. Here's what's clearly a ball. Here's a waste pitch way out here. And then that, it's that area, maybe half a ball width on either side of the strike zone where you don't know for sure if that umpire is going to call it. Maybe that's where Kirk or Jansen help you out. But those are, the edge is also the most difficult spot for a hitter to make a decision. You don't know if something's going to break in or break away. His edge percentage wasn't much higher. It was, those extra pitches in the zone were over the meatier part of the plate. Is that something that is, you know, a warning sign to you, or do you think that's a part of the progression? Hey, throw it in the zone with conviction and then let's nibble once you're more established.
I think it's part of the progression. Okay. And I think it's also hitters. Like, you know, when you can attack, you can.
The Detroit Tigers.
Well, Tigers, and also like situation and stuff. Like I watched every single pitch he threw, and you know, there are times when you throw a fastball right over the plate, first pitch of an at bat. And that's, you didn't miss a spot. It's against a certain hitter at a certain time where you have a really good idea that he's not swinging. So a pitch over the meat of the plate, there's difference, you know, that could be a well-executed pitch or it could be a poorly executed pitch. So context is definitely king there. But I do think, as you said, I agree with what kind of the latter part of that, where, yeah, let's get him in the zone first and then let's dial up the degree of difficulty, dial up the nuance, work the edges a bit more.
Yeah, you're going to want to do that against the, you know, I think Juan Soto might jump on a on a 0-0 fastball exactly. Over the plate, but yeah. But maybe, you know, some guys, maybe a Rougned Odor is not going to, although of course he will in this series because he can never not be annoying.
He's still playing.
He's still pretty much in their lineup, not every day, but against righties with platoon splits, he's usually.
He'll be out of the league soon.
Okay. Just wait until the Jays acquire him at the deadline. No, let's not do that. Let's not do another lefty who's replacement level on this roster. We'll talk trade deadline stuff in a second. But Alek Manoah, so having that one start under the belt, zooming out a little bit, kind of resetting our baseline for him the rest of the season. What do you think a reasonable expectation is for him as a, you know, let's assume it goes well enough that he is staying in the rotation, but what do you think a reasonable baseline is for him?
I think he's got a really, really wide variance of what the possible outcomes are, which makes him...
From, yeah, you're shut down for the season because going down to the minors didn't work, all the way to your third in Cy Young voting.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what makes him... These are the guys that are interesting to cover and interesting to watch and interesting to break down. I think the likeliest scenario is that he quasi figures it out and he's a third, fourth kind of starter. I think getting him back to Cy Young Manoa is an offseason discussion. And that's about getting stuff back to a certain level and getting everything back to just a reset. I don't think that's coming back. But again, the variance and the possibility is still there because we see the talent. He knows pitching. And I've said this from when I first started watching him, he's got a knowledge of reading hitters and reading bats that is not normal for his age.
And even a self-awareness. I remember, I think it was Joe Siddle who had that game and breaking down, well, hey, there were a couple times that Manoa came out of his mechanics and you know, you could see him processing it. And next pitch out, it was back online, especially that, you know, the tempo down the mound that Joe was talking about a lot for that broadcast. So, you know, there's an element of that too, the better you know yourself and your own mechanics. Obviously, we saw him not able to adjust that for a long stretch of time, but, you know, it's there.
I think the likeliest is, somewhere down the rotation, but that's good enough with this team. Like, for the most part, if Gausman comes back and if Bassett stays consistent, you know, that's fine. And they've got a deep rotation and that can work. So, you know, as I said, I think getting him back to Cy Young Manoa is probably an offseason thing. But listen, let's see what happens tonight and let's see where it goes. He's got probably three before the trade deadline. And I think we'll all be watching those starts probably closer than any other starts that the Jays make.
Yeah, those and Hyunjin Ryu's next minor league start if he's not filling in for Gausman this weekend.
He might be with us sooner.
Who knows? Okay, so I know you don't actually believe at any point they'll use a six-man rotation. There is a scenario, and this is to go the wire route. It's one of them good problems. If Manoa were to continue to be good and Gausman is ready to roll and Hyunjin Ryu is, you know, August 3rd is the latest they can push that decision anyway. So it's a little after the deadline, but you got to make a call there. Now, the worst case scenario is all these things are still uncertain enough at the trade deadline that you don't do anything and then they all fall apart. But the second worst case scenario is, that they go poorly. The best case scenario, though, is you have six guys that you're trying to find spots for. And yes, a couple of those guys have been overworked, so you don't mind getting the odd day here and there. But you also shorten the bullpen. It's a bullpen that's been overworked. You don't like the six-man idea at all.
It's not that I don't like it. I just think it complicates things over an extended period of time. Like, I think on a one-off or a two or maybe two times through the rotation, it might help. But I also, 2 minutes ago, I just said they have a really deep rotation, and I agree with that. But also, when you break it down piece by piece, each guy brings a question or two.
Mm-hmm.
Gausman and Bassett both are a little bit older, and they're both kind of barreling towards career highs and innings and pitches and all that stuff. Berríos is probably their kind of most dependable starter, which is kind of crazy. Like, in terms of Gausman's their best starter, but just he's kind of been very dependable and down the middle, which is crazy after all the conversations you and I had last year about him. And then Manoa brings, obviously, we just talked about the variance. And Kikuchi, you know, he's a fifth starter. And he's been good. He's been a lot better than last year. But I don't think he's someone that, you know, is guaranteed to be in the rotation the rest of the way through. And I could also see a scenario where, as they're trying to integrate Ryu, they might kind of handcuff those two guys together.
Mm-hmm.
Where whether it's Ryu starting or I think it'd be Ryu starting, and maybe Kikuchi comes in and gives three innings after that. Because I don't think either of those guys.
You use a righty in between them, maybe. You kind of. Especially against a team that does a lot. I think about the Twins, for example, where they have five guys that are straight platoon or switch hitters. And somehow that awful Twins team is still potentially a wild card opponent because the AL Central is the AL Central.
Let's not talk about the divisions. But I think there's a scenario where instead of a true six-man rotation, they might kind of turn two of those guys into one while still getting – so that way you're still getting some kind of length out of a quote-unquote bullpen spot. So I think Kikuchi could wind up as I heard you talking to Arden yesterday, and I agreed fully, where they're kind of looking for a Lorenzen, a Stripling type, a length. That guy might end up being Kikuchi, and they still might find another starter. So I really don't think there's some people who are kind of pushing aside the idea that they might go get a starter, I think it's a possibility for all those reasons I just kind of listed.
Yeah, there are a lot of uncertainties in a rotation that, again, best case scenario has some really cool pieces. But yeah, you and the other hard part of this is like, you got to make the playoffs. So even if an extra starter maybe doesn't do a lot for you come playoff time, like, you know, Ryu's maybe not on a playoff roster, right? Because he doesn't have the bullpen utility and he's probably not going to be one of your four best pitchers, certainly not on a wild card roster. But yeah, you've got to balance that as well, but you also have to get there. And this is a pretty tight wild card race. So my biggest issue with a six man rotation idea is that it takes away an arm out of the bullpen. You can only have 13 pitchers on your roster, and this is a bullpen that's already been pretty overworked. Eric Swanson, Yimi Garcia, Tim Mesa, all in the top 15 in appearances so far. Jordan Romano, not too far behind. Now, they get Trevor Richards back because you have a fifth starter now. Nate Pearson, I think, has shaken off that blip. So yep, you've got six guys that I think you believe can be six of your eight in a bullpen the rest of the way.
100%.
How are you feeling about the depth beyond that? I know you wanted to talk bullpen stuff, and there's a lot of good, but there are also, you know, Mitch White's still around.
Yeah, well, again, like, I think when the Ryu situation sorts itself out, I do believe, whether you call that a bullpen spot or not, like, I think the likeliest scenario is he comes back, White goes out, and Kikuchi slots into that length bullpen spot. Now, the other thing that could happen, just to take it back to the starters quickly, is like, they just kind of use it as kind of a rotation of, hey, this guy needs a week down. And mm-hmm. That's how you manage the innings of a Bassett and a Gausman and a Barrios and a Kikuchi. And,
but you just run that whole time, then an arm short in the bullpen.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, are there DL stints? I don't know. But I like the depth, especially if Kikuchi becomes a length guy. Chad Green is up in the air. Like, you don't know what that's going
to
be.
We expect him to pitch in live game sometime this week in the minor leagues, by the way, if anyone has missed that update.
Yeah, but you need to like the track record. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're going to get, but you know he's not afraid of leverage. He's not afraid of AL East games. So you need, I think you're going to see what you have there. And even the guys towards the back end have been, Jay Jackson's been great. Like, mm-hmm. You could go get another piece, but also I feel like it's more likely that it's a length quasi starter guy than it is a, you know, back into the bullpen. The bullpen numbers, I dove into them in advance of working this series. It's crazy. Anyone who's not calling them, I mean, we get bogged down in all types of sports. What is elite? What's good? What's like, they've been really, really good. They're top five in all sorts of categories.
ERA, whip, stuff plus, strand rate, strikeout rate, walk rate, chase rate, whiff rate.
Yeah, everything you want a bullpen to be, they've been very good.
Also, here's one that wasn't on your list.
Okay.
If we look at just high leverage, so not runners in scoring position, but the leverage situation of the game as well. And I actually found this because I was looking at the San Diego Padres have been unspeakably bad in high leverage spots. Yeah. Like, you think the Jays have struggled with runners in scoring position? The Padres have something like a 67 weighted runs created plus in high leverage spots, and their pitching staff has been awful in high leverage spots. The Jays pitching staff in high leverage spots, number two in baseball.
Yeah, they've been really, really good, and that ties into this series being a little tougher than we like. The Padres are, and this isn't some grand, you know, eye-opening statement, they're way better than their records suggest. Like, way, way better.
They go Soto, Tatis, Machado, Bogarts through the middle of their order.
Yeah, like, this, it's going to be a fun challenge tonight and this entire series. Like, it's not a team that's 5-6 games below 500. So it's going to be fun to watch. It's another great perk of the schedule that we're seeing teams like this come to town. I'm really excited to be working it. But, yeah, like, the bullpen, the line that I'm going to, you know, tell all my buddies on the golf course or whenever we talk about this team, we always talk about swing and miss, strikeout rate. No Blue Jays bullpen has ever struck out a higher rate of the hitters they face than this bullpen this year. It's Swanson, it's Richards, it's all these guys have been dominant striking guys out. So the swing and miss stuff, the dominant stuff, the striking out, put those arguments to bed. And if you don't trust it, if you don't trust it until the playoffs, like, the easiest argument to make that people can make is, until they go far in the postseason, I'm not going to trust them. Well, guess what? Only one team wins it at the end of the year, and only a couple teams make it. This game is random. This game
everyone hates their bullpen come playoff
time. Exactly. Every fan base hates their bullpen.
Like the Cubs World Series was basically that Cubs Cleveland series was basically a battle of bullpens blowing it back and forth.
Yeah, and it's who gets hot. Like somebody reached out to me on social yesterday after I posted some bullpen stuff, and they're like, we need something like the Royals bullpen in 15. They weren't good in the regular season. They got hot at the right time, and they got dominant. And guess what? When you're hot in the postseason, when everyone's watching you, all those fans weren't paying attention during the regular season. They see you get hot. If you can get hot at the right time, get through the marathon of the regular season, that's all you can hope for.
And the marathon of the regular season is why, despite them having been this good, I would still love to see an extra piece there, and why I don't love the six-man rotation idea is, again, three guys in the top fit. Like, it looks like Nick Nurse has been managing this bullpen.
It's not that bad.
Top 15.
Nurse, we could be February in Detroit. And
yes,
Fred VanVleet's going 44 minutes.
Yes, but of course. Okay, so the bullpen then, it sounds like relative to, you know, what the discussion might be on Jay's Twitter or even on shows like this, you are not as strongly, hey, they got to add bullpen arms. You feel a little differently about the deadline. Now, I know you mentioned a starter / bulk guy. Does that supersede the need for a little bit of position player balancing here? Or is that extra right-handed bat who can hit lefties a little bit and give you some more kind of platoon options, is that kind of front of mind for you?
Listen, I like better players wherever. I'm not going to say yes or like as a fan. Yeah, if they want to bring in better players, I'd be ecstatic. And I really don't think the one thing I disagree with in terms of the dialogue heading into the trade deadline is that they need somebody to hit left-handed pitching. I don't fault the logic of it. They haven't been great against lefty pitching.
They've been pretty bad.
Like, yeah, they've been like, but also, I just feel like if you have a lineup that's George Springer, Bo Bichette, Vladimir Guerrero, Matt Chapman, Danny Jansen, like a bunch of good above average right-handed hitters, the improvement from against left-handed pitching is going to come from the guys you have. Like if it's going to come, like I don't see a guy that's all of a sudden going to, you know, slot in and become an everyday hitter. I know the Tommy Pham name has been out there. I don't love that fit for a few different reasons. I don't care. I guess the clearest way of putting it is I don't think it needs to be a right-handed bat. I'll just take a better position player.
So you're not of the mind, you know, a framing of this would be, well, you need someone who can keep Witt at second base and still spell Varsho and Kiermaier occasionally against lefties and maybe even take some of the belt lefty DH. You don't care about that. You just care about, hey, that Nathan Lucas spot needs to be upgraded.
Exactly.
Maybe that Santiago Espinal spot needs to be upgraded if the right, and whoever that right guy is the right guy.
Yeah, go get somebody that can improve your roster. But I don't think, I think the roster is flexible enough that it can be wherever the opportunity presents itself. I wouldn't be surprised if it's knowing and seeing what they've done over the last few years, if it's somebody with a bit of term left.
That's what it could be, because center field, third base, second base, and DH all potentially open free heading agents, into the offseason.
Yeah, so I can't remember where I heard it. I wish I could give proper credit, but I love, and I have no clue whether this guy's on the market, but I love the idea of like a Ryan McMahon type, a guy who can play second, a guy who can play third, good defender, grinds at bats, veteran, on a team that I don't think would be averse to getting rid of extended money.
And hey, throw Grichuk in while you're talking to Carver.
Is Dangelbart healthy? I don't know. But yeah, I was talking to somebody else about this morning, and when I dropped the McMahon name, they're like, what about Bart? I'm like, yes, I'll take all these good players. But that McMahon type, that type of player fits their MO, flexible, different positions, good, kind of grinds at bats, as I said. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's that. Like, I don't think they're going to tie, if I've learned anything from watching how this team operates, they're not going to tie themselves to a very narrow parameter of what kind of player they're looking for. I think they're going to see what comes at the deadline and see what kind of players and where they can get value from and see where it goes?
I'd aim a little higher than that. Also, just McMahon's owed $56 million over the next 4 years. And yep, he's a lefty who, yes, the positional versatility, but he's never once been a league average bat over a whole season. So although he's at 99 WRC plus right now, so I feel like that's disingenuous of me to say he's never been a league average bat. But yeah, I do think those guys who can, you know, slot it, like this year's version of Whit Merrifield, where it's like, yes, exactly, it's for the run, but it's also for next year. Yep. And obviously the Merrifield thing worked out. Last note on the hitting lefties. Brandon Kuhn sent me the leaderboard of who had the hard hit percentage, yep, against lefties. Still to this point in the season, Matt Chapman has a 70% hard hit rate against lefties.
Well, yeah, this is kind of what I'm, this is kind of where I'm getting
70%.
Yeah, it's very good. And this team will hit lefty. Like, it's very small sample too. Like, it's a whole season or whatever, three quarters of a season, but like, they don't face lefties a lot. They're going to face Snell this week, mm-hmm, I think.
Yep.
They'll probably see a lefty in LA, but they don't see a lot of lefties. And I just, to frame this deadline as they need to improve against lefties just doesn't seem like a big picture thing to me. I understand it. I understand it's something they haven't been good at. But I just, to me, it's just get good players, which, yeah, seems like an oversimplification.
No, I feel similarly to the righty thing the way I felt this past offseason about getting a lefty, which was like, all else equal, yes, a lefty would be preferable to a righty just given what the rest of the roster balance is. But you need to, like, it didn't really matter to me whether Kiermaier and Varsho were lefties. It was just, hey, that's a bonus if you're, you know, or if you got two exactly identical players and one was a lefty, perfect, take the lefty.
Yeah, like, I'm obviously the big Varsho guy, but like, I didn't care which way he hit. And I remember we had a lot of conversations.
Did you care if he would hit period though? Because because well, he might need to try hitting right-handed the last couple weeks.
It will come. I am a big Varsho guy still, but I just, like, I didn't care all that conversation. And I never, I know that was a dialogue, especially after Castillo carved them in the playoffs, like, need to get left-handed. I remember saying to you, you know, Castillo was going to carve anybody that day. He would have carved lefties, he would have carved righties. And it just so happened to me, Varsho and Kiermaier were about defense and about the need to get Springer to a corner outfield spot. What they hit from which side of the plate they hit from was kind of secondary. I think it helped, at least in terms of the roster construction. But yeah, the platoon stuff, unless it's drastic, I don't look at it a ton. I'll take good hitters over a lefty versus a righty.
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, tiebreaker. But yes, maybe, you know, I think the band I used last year was like 5%. I'll take a guy 5% worse if it better helps the versatility and flexibility of the lineup. But anything beyond that, you're cutting off your nose a little bit,
yeah,
to get a lesser player. Where are you at with Varsho in general? I know you said it'll come. If we go back to June 20th, so the last month, we're talking about a 138 average and a 353 OPS. This is a 61 plate appearance stretch. Obviously, we know this team is very high on him and believe in him, and there is the pop there. But what are you seeing within that struggle? Because this is a particularly extreme cold stretch for Darnell.
Yeah, I did a dive on him a while ago, probably a month, 6 weeks ago, and I haven't kind of dove back into the process. You obviously see the high level results. It's an easy thing, and it's not quantifiable, but it does just seem like, when a season starts to get away from you like this, it's tough to kind of get out of the muck. It kind of feels like it's, you're just kind of sinking a bit when you don't get out of it. And it looked like, we all know that there was a moment there in June where it looked like he was coming out of it a bit, mm-hmm, had some good moments, had a couple game winning hits, I think. You know, the defense, the running will always be there. We know that. The hitting, I don't know if it's going to come back, but obviously, like, with a guy like this, he's going to play in the postseason. Like, when it's, he's going to be starting, they're going to, whether or not they win the division or not, who knows, but he's going to be starting game one of the postseason on this team, and they're going to need him for defense. They're going to need him for running. And with a guy like that, when he's having a season like this, all you want is the ability to run into one every once in a while. And that's kind of what we all thought we were going to get as Blue Jays fans is, yeah, he might be
27 homers.
Yeah, like, run into them, make every play in the outfield and run into a few fastballs. And he just hasn't been running into enough.
So maybe tonight is the night Joe Musgrove does not throw the fastest of fastballs. It is one of the highest spin fastballs in the league. He gets that kind of rising vibe to it. Joe Musgrove also has the weird thing that I don't believe in reverse splits over a large sample, but he's done it 3 of the last 4 years. So maybe there's something to that. And if I was going to understand, if I was going to accept it, it would be someone who is a changeup artist. And he throws that about 12% of the time, but it's not like a crazy effective pitch. But you, in the analytics rundown that you sent today, you've picked up something that Joe Musgrove's changed the last little bit. He has gone away from being maybe the preeminent breaking ball guy among high volume starting pitchers to someone who's had to be a little bit more balanced. What did you see diving into Musgrove that we should be, you know, focused on tonight?
Well, I legit didn't know this, but I knew he's a good pitcher. But when I looked at how good his breaking balls were, if you go back a couple seasons to 2021, you know, when I always think of the best breaking balls around baseball in the last, whatever, 5-10 years, it's names like Charlie Morton, that curveball, Lance McCullers, those guys, and they rank up there in run value was what I was looking at. But Musgrove's breaking balls were right up at the top that year. He was dominant. He was throwing them more than half the time, slider and curveball, really, really good. And it just hasn't been nearly as good this year. And to be honest, we don't see as much of these West Coast teams, especially in the old schedule. So I just didn't know that about him. I didn't know his breaking balls were that good that year. But it's changed, and the usage has gone back down. I think it's probably somewhere back down closer to like 40% this year. So it's definitely not as good, but it's something that this is kind of, again, I alluded to it earlier. This is what I love about the schedule now is you get to see these guys a little bit closer. You get to see more of the best players in the league. And it's something I'm going to be watching closely tonight.
The one other thing to watch closely tonight is he does throw that slider a lot to righties.
Yeah.
That's been the pitch that has given him the most trouble.
Exactly.
Some of that, you know, we can look in at the expected stats and things like that. And he's been a little unlucky, but 5 home runs and a .646 slugging against that slider. Might know a couple Blue Jays who are pretty good sitting slider early in counts and jumping on top of that.
Mr. Bo Bichette.
Yeah, seems like maybe a matchup for him. Chris Black, thank you so much for taking the time. You're heading out on the Dome, right? You're doing the series?
Later today. I will be down there Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Yep. I will see you there. You know what I found out recently back in the kind of media area?
Okay.
The little room where they control the actual Dome is back there around where we're hanging out,
like
as
the
well.
Facilities?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Did you push a button?
I didn't,
but it's on my mind. Like the next time that I'm looking outside right now and it's a little overcast, I think it'll be open tonight. But
I just love that spot, that whatever it's called, auxiliary, just where you, me and Petriello hung out for playoff games. All the like very serious journalists who need to do actual writing and stuff, they were down all hanging where they should be. And we were up in this little alcove. It was great.
Yeah.
I was pitching crazy trade ideas.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We were doing Shohei Ohtani trade scenarios. We should get Petriello on the line next week and do some Ohtani trade scenarios with him. Yeah. I have that's a great memory of those playoff games. The rest of what happened in those playoff games, I have no memory of that whatsoever.
I have no recollection.
Yeah. And certainly will not be thinking about it and talking about it a lot as the Jays visit the Mariners this weekend. No, thank you. Future Blue Jay Teoscar Hernandez?
Maybe. He fits in. He's one of those guys that fits in. Yes, a righty bat could help. But yeah, I think he's a possibility.
Weirder things have happened. And weirder things are rumored. Like the Marcus Stroman thing would be stranger than the Teoscar Hernandez thing.
Yes, much less possibility. Single digits, I would say.
All right, Chris Black, thanks again, man. And I'll see you at the Dome a little later.
See you later.
Chris Black of Sportsnet. He'll be producing this series for you if you're catching it on the TV side. I'll be on Blue Jay Central pregame tonight as well, so you can catch up more there, and then I'll be on the radio broadcast alongside Ben Shulman for the Mariners series this weekend. Speaking of radio broadcasts, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to be joined by Tony Gwynn Jr., who also hosts Padres POV on Fox Sports San Diego. He's an Emmy Award winner and is, of course, a former major leaguer himself and the son of the legendary Tony Gwynn. Tony Gwynn Jr. joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Plus, I'm Blake Murphy. Jays, Padres, first of three down at Rogers Center tonight. Alec Manoa, Joe Musgrove will get it going for you at 7 o'clock. Blair and Bark will have you pregame 5 to 7 and then have Jays talk for you again postgame. Over on the Padres side, color analyst Tony Gwynn Jr. joins us now. He's an Emmy Award winner in addition to everything else, host of Padres POV on Fox Sports San Diego. Tony, how are you this morning?
I'm well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. I know there's a lot we could talk about with this Padres team. Let's start at a very high level. What has not been working for this team? I look at the run differential. It's strong. I look at the talent on paper. It's strong. I look at the pitchers the Jays are going to face this week. Really tough. But the Padres haven't been able to put wins together. What is at the core of what's gone wrong for San Diego here?
I mean, it's really been all for the most part on the offensive side. And up until recently, where the bullpen has faltered a little bit in the last week or so. But prior to that, they had been terrific, as well as the starting pitching. It really has fallen on the offense, and it's a few different things, right? You have guys who typically year in, year out, hadn't really swung the bat the way that they were capable of. Manny's gotten it going here late, but for the most part, he was slow to get going. So the same goes for Bogey. He's been dealing with the Xander Bogaerts. I'm sorry, he's been dealing with the wrist injury. So there's been a lot going on. Guys haven't played to their performance level. Jay Cronenworth has struggled this year, and then you couple that with they've been the worst team in baseball, one of the worst teams in baseball with runners in scoring position. It's led to where this team is at today.
When it comes to that inability to hit with runners in scoring position, it's something that has plagued the Blue Jays this year as well. So we've talked about it a lot on this show. And I'm curious as to your take. When you see a team as talented as the Padres struggling with that for 90, 95, 100 games here, most of the stats will tell you that'll even out over time. But this far into the season, do you start to think, hey, there's something about how this team is approaching those situations or even the mental side of it being in their heads a little bit? Are you a believer in that?
I mean, yeah, I think there's a little bit of there's a piece of that in all of it that is the ends up being the outcome, right? I think as a player, as a team, when you are consistently getting into the position that you want to be, which is, having chances with runners in scoring position, I think for a long time, it's just not happening. But at some point, you do start to press, right? You realize that you're not getting it done. So what do? You tend to try harder. And in baseball, it just doesn't work. It goes the opposite way. And so I think there's a little bit of that built in. I think the approach part, there's probably a little bit of that. Obviously, you start to press, approach kind of goes out the window. And that also can be a part of it. So it's all connected. You mentioned the run differential. When the Padres have swung the bats well, it's been an onslaught. It's been what I think everybody imagined. There just hasn't been enough of that.
So when you look at where that team is at and you see the run differential, you see obviously the potential for, I don't think it would shock any of us if this team started clicking a little bit and went on a little run here, but they're almost out of time for the trade deadline. And they're sitting right now, 8 games out of a playoff spot. And it's, there are a couple teams to jump on the way. How far out is too far out for this team? Obviously they're very, very invested in this group. AJ Preller's been really aggressive, but is there a point at which this team would need to consider, hey, we should, Blake Snell's a free agent or Gary Sanchez a free agent. We should maybe sell a piece or two and regroup for next year. Are they too far committed to this group to do that? Or could they fall far enough out of the race to think that way?
I think they're too far committed to this group to do that. I think they're too far committed to that with the fans in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And so, when you've made the kind of commitment that they've made, rest assured, you're going to be held to the fire on that. And so, yeah, I don't think they're in a position. I mean, unless, you know, the rest of this road trip just goes absolutely as bad as it can go, and that carries into the homestand, and, you know, you look up and you're, you know, 14, 15 out. I don't see that being a thing, right? I think this team, as you mentioned, is talented enough. I think you have to hang your hat on. They're going to get hot, and they're going to go on a run at some point. The question will be, will there be enough time? Will there be enough games to be able to get the number low enough to where you can actually jump?
And, you know, if that's going to happen, we, of course, hope it doesn't happen until Friday when they visit Detroit. It doesn't happen these next couple. But if it's going to happen, hey, Joe Musgrove, Yu Darvish, Blake Snell, a pretty good trio to have starting over the course of a three-game series. I know Yu Darvish has, you know, dealt with some struggles, the ERA up north of 4.5. But those other two, Joe Musgrove, Blake Snell, they have been Joe Musgrove and Blake Snell. You said that a lot of the issues have come on the hitting side. What have Musgrove and Snell been able to do to kind of stay above that, especially as, you know, Musgrove's a guy, I know he's had to change his pitch mix a little bit to keep teams from figuring out what's made him so successful.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, let's start with made Blake, I think, really Cy Young type Blake again has been, I think he had a full spring training this year and that allowed him to settle in. Although he got off to a slow start, he still was able to log those innings. Prior to this year, he had been hurt a lot during different parts of the first 2 years, and that slowed his process down where he couldn't really get going to the second half. I just think him having a full spring training, being, you know, familiar with his surroundings has led to him pitching as well as he has. And in Joe's case, he got off to a slow start. He broke his toe in spring training, so he missed all of spring training. His spring training was virtually the first month and a half of the season, and he struggled in that time frame. But really since then, man, he's been, as you said, Joe Musgrove. He's been consistent, tough to deal with. The pitch mix is interesting. I think it was during that struggle in the first month and a half, the slider, which has been his bread and butter, just wasn't right. And so, you know, what he did, what a good pitcher does, he figured out something else. He's gone to the curveball a lot more. He's used his changeup. His fastball has been more explosive this year. And so, you know, when you have guys like that, you can go on that run that we're talking about. You just mentioned Yu Darvish. He struggled as well early on. But his last few starts have been the Yu Darvish that we've come to know.
Yeah, and with Musgrove, you know, it helps when you have six pitches. So if your slider's not working that day, you can go away from it. You mentioned how good Snell's been for any Jays fan who hasn't paid attention. He has allowed just 3 earned runs over his last 9 starts. He is, like you said, Cy Young, Blake Snell right now. Tony, I'm curious as to your take on the other side of this matchup on the Toronto Blue Jays. You know, I know you've talked a lot over the years about your experience as a second generation player and joked a little bit about how people used to use you to mark the passing of time. And you look at this Jays team and there's a Vlad Guerrero, there is a Kevin Biggio, there is a Bo Bichette, a Dalton Varsho. What do you make of the Jays kind of, you know, having this army of second generation guys?
I mean, there's a lot of method to the madness of bloodlines and teams that, you know, draft that way. And the Toronto Blue Jays are reaping the benefit of doing that. And they have exceptional, you know, guys in terms of Bichette and Vlad Jr. I got a chance to see Varsho a lot in Arizona as he was in the division for a while. He's another. I know he struggled a little bit this year, but he's another player that can help you win ball games. And so, I mean, listen, this Blue Jay team is they got a good squad, good mix of young and veterans on the ball club, and they're starting to play some good baseball right now. This team was one of those teams that I think everybody had their eye on, and now they're starting to get rolling. It seems like.
It does seem like that. They've won 8 of their last 9. And yeah, a couple of those were the White Sox and Detroit, and you mix a no hitter in there. But for the most part, starting to play some better baseball. Tony, last one for you before I let you go here. And I apologize if you're tired of answering this one yet. I don't know how much you've been asked about it, but the Luis Arraez chase for 400 is cooling off a little bit now. He's hitting 378, but you know, that's obviously something, the chase for 400, that you and your family and your father know pretty well. How much fun have you been having with Arraez's flirtation with the 400 line here?
I'm rooting for him, man. I think he doesn't get enough credit, you know, for how good he is. I think he's starting to receive some eyes now, but he's been doing this for a little bit now. This is the second year. He won a Batten title last year, and he seems to have raised the level. You just don't see anybody with that skill set. And, you know, it's not something that anybody can do, right? He's the only one really hitting in the manner in which he does. His approach is very similar to what my father's was. And, you know, getting a chance to watch him up close and personal, I was telling a few of our listeners the other day that one of the things he does that you don't see anybody else do in baseball is, as he's, you know, getting ready for that pitch to come, he scans the infield to see where there are open holes at. And you just haven't seen anybody like this in quite some time. I know he's cooled off a little bit, but I wouldn't put it past him to get himself right back in the mix here.
It's hilarious. Over his last 18 games, he's quote-unquote only hitting 290, and that's dropped his batting average down a bunch. It must be nice. Tony Gwynn Jr., thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I appreciate it.
No problem, man. Have a good one.
Tony Gwynn Jr., Padres radio color analyst and host of Padres POV on FSSD. Again, it's Manoah against Musgrove tonight, and a little later in this series, we'll see Berríos, Darvish, Bassett, Snell. Darvish, who's started to turn things around. Blake Snell, who I just mentioned, only 3 earned runs over his last 9 starts, and those have come in 2 games. So 7 of his last 9 times out, he's put a 0 on the board, which is pretty remarkable. Obviously, on the Blue Jays side here, all eyes on Alek Manoah tonight. This weekend, it'll kind of be all eyes or ears, depending on when the updates come, on Kevin Gausman and the status of his sore side. MRIs came back clean, but they're playing it cautious, and that sets up Manoah, Berríos, Bassett on the Blue Jays side. Alek Manoah coming off of his first start back since the trip to the minors, and it was a very successful one relative to where expectations were and what he'd done earlier in the season. But as we've talked about throughout the show and yesterday with Arden a little bit, you know, still some things to keep an eye on, particularly how much that slider is moving and how effectively he's able to throw it in pitchers' counts, because this is a Padres team that does hit righty sliders pretty well. It's a Padres team that if this game gets close late, this can go 2 ways. You can believe. So when I mentioned earlier with Chris Black, and it's something I'm probably going to talk about on Blue Jay Central tonight, this Padres team is the second worst team in baseball in high leverage spots. So big moments in the game, late and close, runners on base in key spots, things like that. We take all that into account. And the only team worse than them at the plate in those situations is the Kansas City Royals, who appear to be actively trying to lose. So that's a good thing for them, not a good thing for the Padres. Now, you can look at that and you can be confident in a late and close game and say, hey, the Blue Jays have this terrific bullpen that's been so good this year. The Padres can't hit in these situations. You like your chances. And that's probably where I'd lean. But there is a small part of me that looks at a team that has Juan Soto, Xander Bogaerts, Fernando Tatis Jr., and Manny Machado in the middle of their lineup and thinks, damn, that team's probably due a little bit of positive regression in those situations. Things should start to turn around for them. They are not dissimilar to where the Blue Jays were a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about how process is strong, numbers overall are strong, but their inability to hit with runners in scoring position. Now, that started to turn around a little bit for the Toronto Blue Jays. They're not beating the brakes off the league in those situations, but they've gone from, you know, being bottom 5 to maybe being bottom 12 in some of those stats. The Padres would settle for that as well, because again, this is a team that has outscored their opponents by 36 runs, and yet they're 6 games under 500. Jays, on the other hand, 12 games over 500 with a stronger run differential, but not a huge difference. And 12 games over 500. I misspoke on their games above 500 yesterday. So this should be a really fun series on a lot of fronts. Really good test for the Blue Jays tonight with Joe Musgrove, who throws six different pitches, has had to minimize the slider a little bit as it gets hit this year. Curveball hasn't been quite as sharp, but it's a pretty good and high spin fastball, one of those rising fastballs that'll feel like it's sitting up in the zone and coming up at a hitter, even though, you know, scientifically that is not true. Also, just be nice to see if the Jays can stay hot here. Winners of eight of their last nine, the lead in the American League East for the Tampa Bay Rays down to 5.5 games. Some opportunity here for the Blue Jays, opportunities they didn't take full advantage of earlier in the year. Ben Schulman and Jesse Rubinoff coming up next. Blair and Barker have you 5-7 pregame. They'll also have you for Jays Talk postgame. Thanks to Caitlin McGrath, Keith Law, Chris Black, and Tony Gwynn Jr. for coming on. Thanks to Jeff Lance and Jennifer behind the glass. Jays Talk Plus back tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. here on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.